Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We have a power-packed empowerment hour. Researchers are poking holes in the modern paleo diet from Georgia State University and Kent State Universities. There was more than one paleo diet, and none of them may have been that healthy. But barely any of the foods eaten are available anymore anyhow. So why the big deal about it? We'll discuss it. Researchers shed light on how diet influences cancer development. Hot flashes are linked to an increased risk of hip fractures, University of California. Wild blueberries, also called bilberries, can help tackle adverse effects of a high-fat diet, University of Eastern Finland. Carnegie Mellon University, an apple a day? Yes, that's good, but could a hug a day keep the doctor away? New research on that. From the European Society of Cardiology, yoga has the potential to reduce the risk factors of cardiovascular disease. And new research in the Journal of Immunology shows that vitamin E boosts your protection against pneumonia, and another key role for vitamin E in the brain, University of Newcastle in Australia. As always, every day, the latest from around the world, always from qualified, independent, peer-reviewed literature. My guest in the second part of our program, from Denver, Colorado, talking about the global loss of ancient wisdom and healing knowledge due to globalization and uncontrolled modernization, is Maria Rose Felinle. She is founder and president of the Healing Planet Project, and she is one of the more profound thinkers on the preservation and dissemination of traditional healing and spiritual methods throughout the world. So she comes from a traditional healing family in Vietnam. And she also, for a long time, was in films for over 20 years. She was a television and film producer. She produced Northern Exposure and Aces High. But she's taken a different track. So we'll talk with her. Time permitting, I'll give you the latest on a leaked WikiLeaks document that shows that the drones, according to the CIA's own documents, they're counterproductive. All right, well, we've known that, but why hasn't the media focused on it? Also, if time permits, the Fukushima endgame, the radioactive contamination of the entire Pacific Ocean, and what it means to all of us, from Professor Michael Chovsky-Dosky from Global Research. Also, if time permits, I'd like for you to hear what Max Kaiser, one of the most outstanding economists in the world. He and Gerald Celente are very similar. And I'd like for you to hear what he has to say about the fall in the price of oil and what that really could do to our economies around the world. So you see, we have a lot to cover today. Let's begin. I'm always asked, gee whiz, Gary, there's a new best-selling book about the paleo diet. Yeah. And exactly where are they getting the food? Just go back to the era of paleo. You did not have at that time any kind of real cultivation. That would come later. So people had to be scavengers, and they had to move wherever the food was available. Also, they had no sanitation. The average lifespan was about 29 years of age, if you were lucky to get there. And they had no way of really protecting themselves unless they stayed in a place like a cave. And also, when they ate, they generally gorged for a simple reason. because you didn't know when you would eat again. So whatever was available, whether it was grubs or insects or some form of carrion, a dead animal, they would eat it. And somehow people have romanticized that, as if these people were healthy. They were not. Long-lived. They had one of the shortest lifespans of any group. But I guess it's sexy in some way that you can try to make something ancient modern again. But it doesn't work. But now, Georgia State University, as well as Kent State University, have just completed this. Quote, the Paleolithic diet, or caveman diet, is a diet, quote, craze, that has become popular in recent times. The dietary approach is based upon eating the way our ancestors did, an idea that in some form has been around since 1960s, but has gained much more popularity in recent years. However, new research has questioned the accuracy of the modern paleo diet, suggesting that following the actual paleo diet would give modern calorie counters great freedom, because those ancestral diets likely differed substantially over time and space. Led by researchers at Georgia State University and Kent State University and published in the Quarterly Review of Biology, the research team examined the paleo environment and the chemical evidence for the paleo, as well as the feeding behavior of living animals. Led by distinguished anthropologist Professor Owen Lovejoy, the team reports that while early hominids were not great hunters and their detention was not great for exploiting many specific categories of plant food, they were most likely dietary jack-of-all-trades. Quote, based on evidence that's been gathered over many decades, there's very little evidence that any of the hominoids had very specialized diets or there were specific food categories that seemed particularly important. So says Dr. Ken Sayers, co-author of the research. So what was a paleo diet? The team offered several points that need to be considered by people wishing to emulate the diets of our ancestors. Firstly, they warn that it's very difficult to characterize what is the paleo diet. They suggest that while advocates suggest certain types of food and a percentage of energy that should come from protein, fats, carbohydrates, these recommendations are based just on guessing. Because historically, a hunter-gatherer might go days with no kill and not come across food. Therefore, there was no way of planning what you were going to eat. There was no percentage of the diet that you would consume. You ate and gorged on everything you could find. It's as simple. There's nothing scientific about it. Quote, I think that you would certainly have lots of variation way beyond what those recommendations are. In addition, the team added that our ancestors lived in a wide range of environments which affected the types of food available. This is clearly observed even today, they said, noting that modern hunter-gatherers in a northern climate may have an almost exclusively animal-based diet, while hunter-gatherers near the equator would rely upon plant-based resources. Furthermore, even the same food isn't the same today as it was during the Paleolithic era. The foods that were eaten today, even in the case of fruits and vegetables, have been selected for desirable properties and would differ from what our ancestors were eating. So, they weren't healthier. They weren't processed foods. But then again, on the other side, just imagine coming across a dead animal. You don't know how long it's been dead. And all creatures that die immediately, within 1 second of death, when the immune system is no longer there to scavenge microorganisms, the bacteria shifts and proliferates in toxins. As a result, the bacteria smells, and that's the smell of death. And then you would have an engorged corpse that would get so full of gases that it would explode, or at least it would rupture. And so imagine how long a person would live if they ate that kind of toxic meat, and yet they would eat anything they could. I guess the romanticists would like to think that these people went fishing and ate the fresh fish and found rabbits and squirrels, and it didn't happen that way. Far from it. So those who want to exploit myths in order to have their moment in the sun, just remember, there's no science behind it. But here's what there is science behind: the Mediterranean diet. And this is from Harvard Medical School. Quote, the Mediterranean diet is linked to an increase in telomere length. Now, you've heard me mention hundreds of times on this program that the object of the exercise each day is to live a life that keeps your telomeres elongated. Anything to keep them from shortening. Because as your telomeres shorten, your lifespan shortens. Longer telomeres, longer life. Shorter telomeres, shorter life. The American diet, with all of its refined carbohydrates and saturated fats and heavy emphasis upon animal proteins, carbonated beverages and coffee and caffeines, it shortens the telomeres. Stress really shortens the telomeres. Lack of exercise shortens the telomeres. Quote, following a Mediterranean-style diet may be associated with greater telomere length, a finding that further supports the diet's links to health and longevity. The data published in the British Medical Journal examined whether adherence to the Mediterranean diet was associated with longer telomere length, a biomarker of aging, finding that greater adherence to the Mediterranean diet was associated with longer telomeres. Led by Marta Kraus-Bau from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, the U.S.-based team analyzed data from 4,500 women from the Nurses' Health Study, cohort study, with telomere length measured, who also completed food analysis. Observational studies and intervention trials have consistently shown the health benefits of a high degree of adherence to the Mediterranean diet, including reduction of overall death, reduced incidence of chronic disease, especially major cardiovascular disease, and increased likelihood of healthier aging, end quote. Now, they added that telomere length is considered to be a biomarker of aging, noting that shorter telomeres are associated with a decreased life expectancy and increased risk of developing age-related chronic disease. No study has examined whether adherence to the Mediterranean diet is associated with longer telomere length. In this large cross-sectional study, greater adherence to the Mediterranean diet was significantly associated with a longer leukocyte telomere length. Our results further support the health benefits of adherence to the Mediterranean diet, end quote. So, here's the takeaway message from this. Life, at its most fundamental level, is simply about choices. The more choices we have, the greater the capacity for those choices to work on our behalf if we make the right choices. But we should not be making choices out of fear, rage, or conditioned response to things from our past, including our comfort levels. We should make our choices based upon what is the desired outcome. What's the object of this exercise? Is it to live a longer life? Is it to have a healthier heart, a healthier brain, healthier skin, better musculature, lower fat, less pain or no pain? Then that's simple. If that is what we desire, then are we willing to manifest the discipline and the focus so that it narrows our selection away from anything that would be compromised to that which gives us our outcome? Then we make healthy choices. Now, there's always a sacrifice when we make a healthy choice. But that's fine, because look at the outcome, or the probable outcome, or the likely outcome. So if I know that, as today, if I woke up, went out for a workout, didn't care whether it was cold or not, because the body's invigorated by it, I know that that exercise will burn fat, help improve digestion, help the body purge toxins. Sweating is also very healthy and necessary. Stimulate the lymphatic system. Increase endorphins, the feel-good hormones. And on top of all that, it also lengthens the telomeres. It keeps them from shortening. Then when I get back, knowing I have a choice, I could have a sugar-coated cereal with milk. I could have some toast or bagel with coffee. I could have a glass of bottled pasteurized orange juice. I could have a glass of that. I could have a donut and coffee. Or I could have, you know, one of the fast foods where you get everything. You know, you're getting a bun, pure carbohydrate, bacon, eggs, and cheese, all common allergens and all going to destroy the telomeres, going to shorten them. Or I could have a big healthy smoothie with a handful of walnuts and some pine nuts and some blueberries and raspberries and concentrates and powders of fruits and vegetables and cruciferous nutrients and grapes and vegetable-based protein and a nut milk and essential fatty acids and coconut oil and blend that together and drink that down and know that for the next 5 hours, my body has everything it needs to have energy, to be in homeostasis or balance, and is healthy, repairing my cells and tissues and DNA, thinning my blood naturally to help prevent stroke and clotting, and helping my skin stay healthy, tighter, my hair, its natural color and thickness longer, my vision improved. That's the difference in choices. So you see, we have all these choices, but more often than not, the choices are not predicated upon, do we want to live a longer and healthier life? Most people would say yes. Or they would say yes, but then they don't want to do what actually causes it. Very few people, probably less than 5% of the American population, which is still, on the good side, that's still 16 million people, are going to make good choices all day long in everything they do. And that's how you keep your telomeres long. And that's why the Mediterranean diet, unlike the paleo diet, is sensible, scientific, and a good model to use. For those of us who are vegan, we follow the Mediterranean diet. Low heat, slow cook foods, so their nutrients are not denatured. And I actually did the research to show at what temperature are nutrients denatured and to what degree. And there's so many myths in the world of health, just gazillion myths. I never will forget that there was this guy who will stay nameless, and he came to a conference that there were just two of us at as speakers. It was a one-week conference of all these financial managers from around the world, and cumulatively they managed over $1 trillion. I mean, the largest financial manager from Japan, Russia, and different countries. And they were all interested in the health movement. So I gave them 8 hours of time to explain what I felt was needed to get Americans healthy and to keep them healthy, and at the same time to challenge the limitations of our medical industrial complex. Use what medicine works and do not use what does not work. And how we could get a single payer coverage and have a national preventive program and have enough voices outspoken to get surgeon generals that are actually models of health, not the ones we've had in the past. So anyhow, they took all this in, and then I had to leave. But before I left, there was a delay because of a hurricane, so my flight wasn't coming for a day. So I listened to this other fellow. I just stayed way in the back, and I'd never heard such nonsense. You have to drink your juice within 7 minutes or the hydrogen is lost. It's not true. And if you cook a food over, 110 degrees, it's destroyed and causes cancer. not true. And he went on and on and on. Every single word out of his mouth was not true. So after lunch, I saw him and I got him aside. I said, I'm curious about this. Where are you getting your facts? Well, it's just common knowledge. It's in the science. I said, well, I happen to have done that scientific research for 31 years at the Institute of Applied Biology. So I know that the nutrients are not, underline, N-O-T, not destroyed at 110 degrees. You're wrong. Do you have any science on your side? He didn't. But he did have a marketing plan, and that would come out later, as I would find out, to sell his raw program. And when I heard about the raw, I asked him, how many people do you think are sick today because they went on a 100% raw program? What do you mean sick? It's vital health. No, it's not. Certain amount of raw? Yes. All raw? You're running a big risk of getting sick. But you see, the industry looks at fads and people who are out there promoting something rather than good quality science. So here's just a basic rule. We should all be eating 100% living foods, meaning there's enzymes, there are antioxidants, phytonutrients, which, by the way, are really strongly heat resistant, and quality fibers, complex carbohydrates, all of these, and the amino acids. That's what we actually need. The form those take should be in a quality diet with a lot of variety. And as long as you're having about 70% raw, which there's your fruits and your juices and your salads, and even some soups raw, that's fine. And then the things like a tomato actually has more enhancement of its bioavailability when it's lightly cooked. The science is there. The studies are there. Eating a tomato, you do not get the same nutritional benefit as eating a tomato sauce. So the Mediterranean has focused upon low heat and slow cooking for millennia. They've done it right. So if you substitute the meat that occasionally is in there, or the fish that is strongly in there, for non-flesh, then you actually step one step ahead in health. But it's still the best diet out there right now. Researchers also shed a light on how diet influences cancer development. This is from the University of Geneva. Quote, numerous studies have linked high-calorie diets, that's the American diet, that's the English diet. The only difference between the American and English diet is the American diet has made it taste good. The English diet is just, well, it's just an abomination. Anyhow, even in their so-called best restaurants, one day I'll remind myself to tell you the story. My daughter, Shelley, who's a chef, she's a gourmet chef. Many of you have had her wonderful dishes. By the way, yesterday I went over 5 new recipes with Shelley. I said, Shelley, these are really challenging. No one would ever think these are healthy. They look just like the most calorie-intense sugar-sweetened desserts ever. But they're low-calorie, they're living foods, and I made them up. So she's going to make them. When she gets them done, I'm going to put the word out and everyone can have a taste testing and get your feedback. They're going in the new cookbook I'm doing. In any case, we spent almost 3 weeks in London, and trying to find a good restaurant was not the easiest thing in the world. But I'll talk about that on a different occasion. In any case, here we have these studies showing that high-calorie diets increase the risk of cancer. This is the University of Geneva. Quote, and researchers found that switching from a low to high-calorie diet encourages tumor growth. It's published in Medical News Today, and it just talks about the dangers of all these calories. And then it goes through the mechanisms of how a high-calorie diet. So what's the takeaway message here? The takeaway message is, what has high calories? What has low calories? An apple, low calories. Vegetables, low calories. Seeds, low calories. High calories, concentrated sugars, fats, meat. look at the average sandwich. That's a high-calorie food. So go to low-calorie and help prevent cancer. Finally, hot flashes linked to increased risk of hip fracture. University of California, quote, a large cohort study reveals association between menopausal symptoms and bone health. This was published in the Endocrine Society's Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Quote, women who experience moderate to severe hot flashes and night sweats during menopause tend to have low bone mineral density and higher rates of hip fracture than peers who do not have menopausal symptoms. Okay, here's what we can do for that. Here's the good news. Because I just had a paper presented at the World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine last week on this very study that I did. Now the study's 3 years old, and where we reversed bone thinning, osteoporosis, night sweats, hot flashes, everything in the way of menopause in a group of 287 women. If you want to prevent your bones from thinning, men and women, calcium and magnesium in equal amounts, about 800 to 1,000 milligrams a day. Boron, about 5 milligrams a day. Manganese, about 5 milligrams a day. Silica, about 10 milligrams a day. Phosphorus, about 25 milligrams a day. Vitamin D3, 1,000 units a day. Vitamin K2, about 2 milligrams. And also about 300 milligrams of soy isoflavones. And about 1,000 milligrams of bioflavonoids. That is a protocol to help for protecting and remineralizing your bone. All bone, jawbone, all bone in the body. One last one here. Wild blueberries can help tackle adverse effects of a high-fat diet. University of Eastern Finland. Eating bilberries diminishes the adverse effects of a high-fat diet, according to this recent studies. And bilberries, which are actually wild blueberries, were shown to, quote, have beneficial effects on both blood pressure and nutrition-derived inflammatory responses. That's good. So, bilberries are wild blueberries. They're small, and you can get them dried and snack on them or throw them in a blender. And they will help the fat burn better in the body, helps your metabolism of fatty acids. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Noll. In about 10 minutes now, we'll be going to our guest in Denver, Colorado, to talk about the global loss of ancient wisdom and healing knowledge due to globalization and uncontrolled modernization with Marie Rose Fananle. But before then, people are always interested in what's happening with the economy. And Gerald Salante and I, the other night, in Rosendale, at the Rosendale Theater, following the premiere of the brand-new documentary on poverty in the United States, we had a discussion. And Gerald, as always, gives us great insights from his trends research. And he said that we're in for a really bad time, starting this coming year and going into the next year. Now, he's never been wrong on these, by the way. In 30 years I've been following his work, he's been spot on. So I want you to hear from Max Kaiser now for about 11 minutes, where he's taking, with his associate in London, He's taking on the issue of the price of oil and what it means, because most people are not aware of how the price of oil is impacting the world and what the likely outcome of that will be. Here's Max Kaiser.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Let the blood bathing begin. Stacey.
Max, there's a bloodbath in the markets, and it started in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, or the Arabian Gulf, as some people call it. The Saudi, the Qatari, the Kuwaiti, all these markets are tumbling. Dubai was down almost 8% at one point. MR Properties was down 8%. Remember, with the previous financial crisis, the previous financial crash, it was the same property group who went bankrupt, essentially, and Abu Dhabi came in and rescued it all. But a lot of this is driven, obviously, by oil, the oil price crash, just as in 2008. And the first headline, oil price collapse, claims West Australian Red Fork Energy shale gas company in receivership. The collapse of the oil price has snared its first West Australian victim, with Red Fork Energy losing the support of its major lender.
Well, the shale industry, as we've been pointing out, is unsustainable. Even with oil at $120 a barrel, the shale industry in America, shale oil and shale gas, was an economically unviable hoax. So with oil at $50, $60 a barrel, then the bankruptcies will tumble through that industry and cascade through the entire global financial market. And what's interesting is that banks, you mentioned 2008. Before the crash of 2008, banks were buying insurance on other banks because they were the counterparties. They held the risk that the home the originator of the loan would have. They'd sell it off to another bank. But they realized that the other bank was insolvent, so they were buying insurance on the other bank. And then that bank looks at the original bank and says, wait a minute, those guys are insolvent, and they're buying insurance on that bank. So we see the market for bank insurance in the credit default swap market go up because the banks know that we're getting ready for another huge bank failure.
Yes. And, you know, we were one of the first people in the world to be warning of this back at $120 a barrel of oil about the shale industry. But most importantly, people pouring money into the junk bond market. Okay, you know, the prospectors themselves, fair enough. You want to go out there and, you know, prospect and try to find your little barrel of oil to sell to the market and make your fortune. That's one thing. But who is buying these junk bonds at 4.5%, by the way, at one point? That was the lowest, the average of the energy junk bond market went, is like, who is taking so much risk for so little money? And now Bloomberg News is asking the same question. I see Fed bubble bursts and $550 billion of energy debt. The danger of stimulus-induced bubbles is starting to play out in the market for energy company debt. Since early 2010, energy producers have raised $550 billion of new bonds and loans as the Federal Reserve held borrowing costs near zero. With oil prices plunging, investors are questioning the ability of some issuers to meet their debt obligations. Research firm Credit Insights predicts the default rate for energy junk bonds will double to 8% next year. Many are saying it's going to be far more than that.
All right. The income from a junk bond is used to collateralize more bond issuance. And so it's $550 billion origination in the junk bond relating to this shale industry. But it's collateral for hundreds of billions and probably a trillion or more in loans throughout the system. So if you pull the rug out from underneath this, you know, what's interesting is that the peak oil scenario, which people were talking about for a long, long time, was hinting at peak supply, that the supply of oil would hit an unsustainable level. But in fact, it looks like at the moment anyway, the peak oil scenario can be characterized as we had peak demand. In other words, the economy is going into massive deflation, and the demand for oil is what's driving the price down, is that there is no demand for oil, relatively speaking, and all the money printing in the world is simply going into a black hole of debt and not stimulating enough economic activity to up the demand for oil.
So, I mean, let's talk about the last crisis. It was called the credit crunch because, remember, there was no credit available. Now, we saw this with the Red Fork Energy. So their credit is being pulled. Their credit lines are being pulled. In the shale oil industry across America, you're also seeing that credit lines are being pulled. They can't raise new money to roll over all of this debt. You also see the fact that the bid is being pulled on the oil. This is why people are describing how the price of oil is crashing, is because there's no bid. There's nobody bidding for it.
Well, I mean, the old debate was inflation versus deflation.
Yeah.
And the people who said, no, we're having inflation, would say, look at the price of oil. Well, the price of oil was being held up by the cartel, OPEC. Now OPEC has walked away from the cartel. They've pulled their bid. So now the price of oil reflects deflationary trends around the world, and it crashed.
But again, you know, the price, demand price, you know, companies go out of business and stuff like that. But it's the knock-on effect, all the derivatives. Remember, with this new budget, the $1.1 trillion budget that's passed the Congress, that the derivatives are now back on the books of the taxpayer in America. So when these derivatives are, that's what is going to drive everything into chaos and a spiral like we had in 2008. And this Bloomberg article points out that the Fed's decision to keep benchmark interest rates at record lows for 6 years has encouraged investors to funnel cash into speculative-grade securities to generate returns, raising concerns that risks were being overlooked. A report from Moody's Investor Service this week found that investor protections and corporate debt are at an all-time low, while average yields on junk bonds were recently lower than what investment-grade companies were paying before the credit crisis. So here, you know, this is something that the Kaiser Report has been saying over and over for the past few years, is that these 0% interest rates were driving people who had no reason to be there, these mutual funds, these pension funds, were driving into these, you know, junk bond markets that they were not being paid for the risk they were taking.
Right. Well, these huge pension funds have to make a certain amount of money every single year to pay off the pensioners, to avoid going bankrupt, becoming, you know, running out of money to pay the pensioners. And so they are always in the business looking for a yield, looking for ways to get enough income on their securities to pay off their pensioners. And the government bond market went to zero because of the zero interest rate policies. So they look at the corporate bond market, and the corporate bond market was jacked up to a level where they weren't getting enough yield for their pension account obligations. So then they go to junk bonds in the oil sector market, and they drove the price up to the point where the yield at 5% is what the government bonds used to be paying 15 years ago. So now with the collapse of that pyramid scheme of the junk bond shale Wall Street financed Ponzi, all these things are now being realized that they can't pay.
Again, the other thing that's been bad throughout this so-called recovery has been wages across the UK, the US, Europe have declined in real terms by 9%. So the article also points out that employment and support services for oil and gas operations has surged 70% since the U.S. expansion began in June 2009, while oil and gas extraction payrolls have climbed 34%. But this takes us to the next headline. Tumbling oil could take thousands of jobs with it. So Halliburton has just announced huge layoffs. We saw the last episode. Norway has let go 7,000 jobs, paying on average $180,000. Well, according to Fatima Iqbal of Azad Asset Management, over 15% of total employment gains since the beginning of 2008 have come from the energy industry, even though it is less than 1% of the country's job base. So the average income in the oil services sector in America is $96,844. And now some people are going to say, well, the consumer gets more income because of $1.1 trillion or $1 trillion worth of lower oil gasoline prices. So it might drive more consumer demand. But those jobs in the retail sector in America averages like $20,000, $21,000 a year.
Right. Well, that's deflation. So that's more deflation.
Yeah.
And now here's where the interesting split in economic theory occurs, because there are those who believe that all this massive money printing that's going on to try to stimulate the economy is a dead end, because you're just basically providing a blood transfusion for a corpse. So they advocate, let the bonds default, let the banks default, let the economy find its level of where prices can clear without the government being the market maker, because then that would no longer be capitalism. That would be more of a state-sponsored, socialist model. Then there are those like in the New York Times, Paul Krugman, who says that the reason why there's no growth and why deflation keeps ravaging through the global system is because there's not enough money printing. So he would encourage doubling and tripling and make the debt of the United States go from $18 trillion to $36 trillion or $72 trillion. That's what they believe. The Keynesians believe that there's no penalty for debt. Now, the one country that's experimenting with this would be in Japan, where the debt to GDP is approaching 300%. They just got a mandate to put Abenomics to extend this model, even though the yen is crashing. There is no growth whatsoever, and all that money printing is going into failed experiments like shale gas and shale oil, which is like putting money into a company that loses 50 cents on every dollar they generate.
Also, you know, so here we're talking about the crash possibly happening in the credit derivatives market regarding shale oil and in the energy junk bond market, but we're at 0% interest rates already. So what are the Fed, what are the ECB, what are these people going to do? But on top of that, we've always had Japan, and Japan had massive savings. And that's now been depleted completely over the 30 years. That 300% GDP, debt to GDP ratio, at least it was from domestic savings. It's not from outside debt holders. But they're at the point where they've depleted domestic savings. That's all gone. They're going to have to go out to the market. So this is the credit market.
So you see that the falling oil prices will be good for Americans because of lower prices at the fuel tank, but the airlines who are saving money actually increase prices. They're exploiting it. And it's going to be a mess as the prices go down. So now is the time to incentivize renewable, solar, geothermal, wind, current, the type of sustainable technologies that exist now. Before we go to our guest, let me just mention this from John Quealy from Common Dreams. Leaked internal CIA document admits U.S. drone program is counterproductive. WikiLeaks yesterday made public a never-before-seen internal review conducted by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency that looked at the agency's drone and targeted assassination programs in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, elsewhere. The agency's own analysts found that its clandestine drone and assassination program was likely to produce counterproductive outcomes, including strengthening the very extremist group that was allegedly designed to destroy. The article is entitled Best Practices in Counterinsurgency, Making High-Value Targeting Operations an Effective Counterinsurgency Tool. In one of the key findings contained in the CIA report, agency analysts warn of the negative consequences of assassinating so-called high-level targets. Quote, the potential negative effect of a high-level target operations include increasing the level of insurgent support, strengthening an armed group's bonds with the population, radicalizing an insurgent group's remaining leaders, creating a vacuum into which more radical groups can enter, and escalating or de-escalating a conflict in ways that favor the insurgents. WikiLeaks points out that this internal prediction, quote, has been proven right in the years since the internal review was conducted near the outset of President Obama's first term. And despite these internal warnings, which have been loudly shared by human rights and foreign policy experts critical of CIA's drone assassination programs, WikiLeaks also notes that after the internal review was prepared, quote, the U.S. drone strike killings rose to an all-time high. So, what we've learned from WikiLeaks is that the government, the CIA, knows that its program is actually creating more terrorists than was there before, giving other radical terrorist groups even greater opportunity than they've had otherwise. It's not working, but that's what I've been saying for years. Once you create a bureaucracy, once you create satellite companies that are in the private enterprise, all that, they never stop getting funding, and they never stop trying to legitimize their original need. So now we have a whole industry of hundreds of thousands of people working in private industry, actually having more control than the government, getting unlimited amounts of money, hundreds of billions of dollars being wasted on a program that has completely failed. plus cost an awful lot of innocent people to lose their lives. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go to Colorado and say hello to Marie Rose Flanay. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. I gave your bio a little earlier in the program, and also you are the director of the award-winning documentary film Talking Story.
I am.
About your quest to preserve the wisdom and legacy, and the website is talkingstory.com. There's a certain hubris that has been nurtured by European Western civilization during the course of the industrial and now technological revolutions. That is the genesis of our secularized West is more evolved and more advanced than other ancient, indigenous, and traditional cultures. That's what we are told. Mm-hmm. And attempts to equate intelligence and let's say, the genius with our technological society in a Darwinian sense. And critics would say that Western civilization is actually a denigration of the powers of the human mind and the spirit, and technological innovation has little to do with the real human genius that is now contributing to uncontrolled environmental destruction and the eradication of older cultures and traditions. And since you have a foot planted in firmly in both the traditional cultures of indigenous healing practices and Western technological society, speak about the conflicts that you have encountered between these two competing paradigms, and what are your greatest concerns about the demise and loss of ancient healing cultures and traditions, and how does humanity become more impoverished when the elders and healers of a tradition pass away and their living legacy is lost?
Yes, it's been something that I've personally felt a loss from being someone who was born into war and then being able to survive that and thrive in a different environment, but there's definitely a loss of cultural connection. And in my travels for my projects, my film and my book, I really learned that the loss of ancient healing traditions and spiritual wisdom leads to a loss of what my friend Dr. Tara Lumpkin terms loss of perceptual diversity. So when we lose the way, the variety of ways that we look at the world or that we look at the cosmos or we look at ourselves, we're also losing a pathway toward creative problem solving. And then just in a very practical terms, we're losing our collective medicine cabinet. You know, the world's pharmacopoeia is shrinking now. And with the work that you've been doing, Gary, you've spoken a lot about the different options we have to reach wellness and health. And every time we lose a tradition or we lose a plant, we lose an elder, our collective medicine cabinet begins to shrink. And so that's, you know, and it's an alarming loss, not just emotionally, but practically speaking. So for me, my work, you know, I started with some hubris in terms of how I was going to change the world and try to stop this from happening. But I found that what has worked for me is that I am a filmmaker and a storyteller. So the way that my way to help preserve these traditions is to transform them into a different form that we can use in modern culture.
I appreciate that. There are about 5,000 languages still spoken in the world today. Mm. However, their number is dwindling rapidly as plant and animal species are also rapidly dwindling. And with every language that goes extinct, so does a huge body of human wisdom that is contained in those languages. I once had the former General Secretary of UNESCO, Federico Mayer from Spain, on this program, and he warned about how globalization was extinguishing these languages and traditions and how much poorer humanity will be afterwards, particularly regarding medical wisdom and knowledge. How do you perceive humanity becoming more impoverished when the elders and healers of cultures pass away and their living legacy is lost?
Well, I believe that when we lose that kind of resource, our collective memory and identity as a species has fewer pathways towards survival and thriving. Everything that has been learned in the past is something that can serve us for the future. And, you know, as your show highlights every day, we have a great many challenges ahead of us. And the fewer options and solutions we give ourselves by destroying the past and not looking critically at what hasn't worked and what could work, we become impoverished as individuals and we become impoverished as a collective.
Okay. Well, then following that, there have been many traditional healers and shamans who have been guests on this program over the years. And however, besides your experiences with shamans, you have also witnessed and experienced yourself personally the role oracles play in a society. This was a role your aunt held, having accepted the invitation to be an oracle, and your great-grandfather as a blind healer, both in Vietnam. And then your experiences with the Tibetan and Nepali oracles who play a critical role in the health and social balance of their culture. So please share some insights of the oracle traditions, their role in health, and how does an oracle differ from a shaman?
Yes, an oracle tends to be someone who brings in an energy or an entity into their body that would be considered wiser or have greater knowledge or greater perspective than the human being that's being used as a vehicle. And then a shaman is someone who actually travels to the other realms to gather information and knowledge and healing protocols. And so the oracle tradition is something that's sometimes hard for Westerners to wrap their heads around because it seems very out there. And you know, it is in terms of when we're walking around the world doing our day-to-day things in the modern culture. It seems, you know, kind of spooky or very, very strange. However, we found that in many of these oracle traditions, the word that comes from the spiritual realms have been helpful in solving some human problems. It's known that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has the state oracle, and he has counted on that tradition and on that oracle to help him escape from the atrocities in Tibet to be able to do his work in the world today. And so for me to have been able to have it within my family and witness it in person, it was very powerful, Gary. And even the fact that I have it in my family, it wasn't something that was around all the time. So to be able to go to Nepal and go to different places where this spiritual tradition is practiced was so powerful, because to see someone change before your eyes from the human that you might know with the human personality into another being that seems to have vision beyond the material is, in some ways, it can be a bit intimidating. And in other ways, it's also reassuring that there's something that is greater than my human mind can grasp.
My final question, the domineering influence of what is called evidence-based medicine, which I personally believe acts and functions very similar to a radical religious cult, and it's founded upon a literalist, fundamentalist view of science in virtually all of our universities, medical schools. It's intent on destroying anything that hints at alternative, non-drug-based and traditional medical practice. So when we speak of integrative and complementary medicine, we're not discrediting all modern medical outright. What alternative medical practitioners request is a dialogue and a complementary or integrated approach that permits patients to have access to the best that traditionalist, alternative, and modern medicine models have to offer, simply not offered today. What do you observe traditional healers in their indigenous cultures having to offer modern physicians that could maybe open up a greater dialogue than the biases that have existed today?
I think that one of the greatest things is to look at us beyond kind of a mechanistic model. The human being is more than the parts and the function. And so I feel that the indigenous traditions always include the spirit, the emotions, the psyche, as well as the physical being in terms of how we function. And so it's, you know, you can think of someone, are you a mechanic or an artist? And for me, the indigenous way of healing, it takes a bit of artistry. You take into consideration the whole being. So there's a context within which the content of the symptoms are expressing. And I think that's the most important thing, that one is perceived as a whole being, and therefore any dis-ease, state, or illness has a context within which it's expressing, and therefore the healing and or the cure is traced to the source more accurately. I hope that makes sense.
It sure does make sense. Thank you very much, Maria Rose, for all the good work you've done on this topic.
Thank you very much, Gary. I really appreciate being on your show.
Her book is Talking Story, One Woman's Quest to Preserve Ancient Spiritual and Healing Traditions. Her website is talkingstorybook.com, and her name is Marie Rose. And let me spell it for you, P-H-A-N-L-E, pronounced Falenle. I appreciate all of you listening today. Look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day, everyone. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi, standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I know this is a little bit off the beaten track, but it's a timely question for you from your audience. The other day, I met with someone who used to be in our health support groups about 10 years ago, and the typical chant is, I fell off the protocol, like someone pushed them off a protocol. This is the time of year that I get emails from your audience saying, as we go into the holidays, we're visiting our friends and relatives, how do we stay on course with our protocol, our lifestyle protocol, when we're surrounded by people that are eating pumpkin pie and turkey and crap like that?
Okay, I would have a different way of looking at this. I wouldn't suggest that anyone ever falls off the wagon. I was head of drug interdiction at the Institute of Applied Biology and worked with Trevaga Hospital across the street, where we had thousands of people who had addictive behavior, and I offered in a different approach, and it worked, and so that's where we went. No one ever fell off the wagon. Those were active choices. If you choose to drink, eat, if you take a drug, if you choose, you know, to binge out on sugar, those are choices. And we're making those choices because there's some void in our life we want to fill. There's some feeling we want to get to. If it's a blissful state, if it's a comfortable state, if it's a historical remembering of when we were in pain at some level and food, let's say, was a way of feeling better, whatever the underlying origin, it's about choices. So a person who has a healthy lifestyle and a healthy attitude, they never have a problem associating with people who have different choices. It's not to condemn them. It's not to put yourself above them. That's not the way it works. We live in a very multidimensional society where we're always going to be faced with people who have a different perspective on a lot of different issues than ourselves. Why not simply allow them to be who they are and simply be who you are without there needing to be any form of antagonism or judgmentalism? It's that simple. I don't have a single friend that eats the way I do. In fact, to the contrary, all my male closest friends, none are vegetarian, let alone vegan. But that doesn't limit our friendships. It just means that I have to respect that as a part of their choice, they have selected animal products as what they want. So that's them. It's not me. My choice is to honor me and not to be upset in any way or judgmental when I'm around them. So go home and enjoy the holidays. Remember, you're there not just to enjoy what will take about 45 minutes of eating food. You're there for the whole day, for the energy of the people, for reconnecting with friends and family you may not have seen in a while, and rekindling all the things that you've done since then, because almost all reunions are about what you've done before and reminding each other of the significance of those remarkable moments in our lives. where we have a moment to sit with someone, look at them in this moment, a year or 2 years or 10 years later, and recall what gave us joys earlier in life. That's the purpose of getting together with people. It's not an issue what they're eating. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thank you.
Great. Well, it's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
Okay, Eutrice Lead right now.